who couldn't be with us for family reasons. And I'd like to, before I carry on, express our appreciation to the University of Chichester for their very much appreciated support for this event and a very a liaison with Small Wonder that seems particularly synergistic. So thank you very much, whoever's here from the University of Chichester. Now, I think that many of you already know that the ethos behind the Asham Anthology and Award. You know about the ethos, but I'll just summarize it very quickly so that what happens next makes most sense. It was initiated around the time of the inaugural Orange Prize in order to encourage previously unpublished female writers. The concept of the biannual competition and then the resulting anthology is that it consists of competition-winning stories selected by an eminent panel of judges, plus commissioned work by established writers. This year's competition had a ghost or gothic theme, inspired by Sarah Waters' latest novel, The Little Stranger. Sarah was one of the judges of this year's competition. She's one of our most popular writers of literary fiction, and four of her novels, Tipping the Velvet, Affinity, Fingersmith, and The Night Watch, have been televised. Naomi Alderman and Kate Clancy are two of the commissioned writers in the anthology. The other commissioned writer and judge is Polly Sampson. The only reason that she's not on the platform is that she's reading from her own short story anthology later on this afternoon. I'm sure a lot of you will attend that event. And then she's also participating in an event that revolves around Daphne du Maurier's short stories, because Polly wrote the introduction. So we're giving her a rest this morning. Naomi is a short story writer, novelist, and computer games guru. She's an Asham Award alumnus. I wasn't sure whether I should say alumnus or alumna, but I plumped for alumnus. As one of her stories won third prize in a previous collection. Her novel Disobedience won the Orange Prize for New Writers and was serialized for BBC Radio 4. Kate Clancy is a prize-winning poet and short story writer. Last year, she won both the V.S. Pritchard Prize and the BBC Radio 4 National Short Story Prize. Stephanie Anderson, who's chairing this event, is the chair of the Asham Trust, which supports and manages the award. And by the way, I should say that the name of the award, the Asham Award and the Asham Anthology, was itself inspired by a house nearby that Virginia Woolf, who's of course very closely associated with Charleston, lived in for a very critical creative period of her life, and in which she wrote the story, The Haunted House. So that seems particularly appropriate. Stephanie, as well as being the chair of the Asham Award, was formerly the national director of the Arvon Association and currently works as a coach for people involved in creative projects as an editor. Now, the format of this session is that we'll start with a reading from Kate Clancy from her commissioned story in the anthology. Sarah will follow with a secret story, which she will reveal when she starts reading. Naomi will then read from her Asham anthology story. And then Stephanie will conduct a conversation and then invite questions from the audience. So I'm have great pleasure in handing over to Kate Clancy.
Well, last year I suddenly burst into prose, and after 15 years as a published writer, I very excitingly got a literary agent, which I'd never had before. Because poets don't have literary agents, because 10% of what a poet earns is not sufficient to keep them. So I was very excited to suddenly be invited to a literary agent's party and meet a literary agent. And also, at the same time, I very excitingly went from having no phone at all to having an iPhone. So both these elements of suddenly leaping up a technical step are in this story. My story is called The Real Story, and it's being told by a young, keen literary agent named Susanna, who seems to be slightly on the back foot. She's explaining something to the firm of Burns, Pope, Wilde, and particularly to the senior partner, who's called Giles. And she's obviously done something that she's obviously let something slip. We're not quite sure what it is. And she's explaining the story of how this happened. And what happened was she was going through the slush pile and she came across a very interesting set of poems which are handwritten. So at first she thought they were designed for an iPhone handwriting app, but then she discovered that they were poems. And not only that, even though they were poems, she took herself off to the place of origin. But the person who'd written them wasn't on the phone, didn't have an email number. It was quite extraordinary. She went off into the north of England, where she hadn't been before. She went past Leeds, she went past Hebden Bridge, where she points out you can still shop. And then she had to get in a taxi. Not only that, once she got in the taxi stopped in the road, and the taxi driver explained that the area beyond was not on any sat-nav, and that he wouldn't recommend her going there. He said, "Them's the pixels, we don't go there anymore, not since what happened to Edgar." And at that moment, she found herself abandoned. But Susanna is a very spirited girl, and even though her iPhone wasn't working, not even the compass utility, she set off across what she vaguely thought was the only path across the moor to find out the author of these poems. But, you know, halfway down, she sits down, and that's where the story, I'm going to pick up the story. "I'm not much of an outdoor girl, but I remembered it's important to keep hydrated, especially in extreme conditions. So after a mile or so, I stopped and broke out the San Pellegrino. I was in a dell, I guess, sort of a dip, in a sunny bit. There was a stream running down a cliff, maybe 6 foot high. Then it broadened out into a nice kind of brook affair. I mean, I suppose the water had to be polluted. It did foam on the waterfall, but it was clear in the stream. Brown and clear, like beer. So if you can believe it, I took off my Converses, rolled up my skinnies, waded out to a nice flat stone in the middle and sat there, cooling my ankles in the flowing Newcastle brown. I even got out my aviators, popped them on. It all looked better like that, in sepia, more natural. The wind burped and burbled, and I guess there's that birds that sort of gurgle too, but I know a laugh when I hear one. Something flicked in at the corner of my eye, something white, and I heard it again, a chilly, uppity, intellectually superior, snorty sort of giggle. I took off my glasses and I couldn't see anything. I put them on, and there she was, on the opposite rock, a 5 foot figure in a Laura Ashley 90, crouched on her haunches. Thick, dark hair and a grey little goblin face with bushy eyebrows and this horrid, horrid, quizzical expression, like, what the fuck, townie, at me and my sonnies. Well, I didn't run away. Point for that, please. I said, 'Hi, I'm looking for Ellis Bell.' 'Ellis Bell,' she said, grinning. 'Yes,' I said, 'you see, he sent me some poems. He sent poems. And I've come all the way from London to see about them.' 'From London to see about them,' she said. And let me tell you, I had by this time noticed the repeating trick and was just a teensy bit off-put. 'Do you know Ellis Bell's address?' I said. And she stood up on her rock. You could see how thin she was through her nighty thing. Muscly little monkey legs and a horrible dark triangle at the crotch that I'm fairly sure was not a thong. Her feet were bare, gripping at the rock like a hobbit. 'Ellis Bell's address,' she said, pointing down the road. I stood on my rock, followed the line of her arm. I saw a squat, square, grey house squatting, psycho-like, on the horizon. 'There,' I said, quailing. 'Here,' she said. And when I turned, she wasn't there. And yeah, you can write it up as performance art. You can say she's super shy and she's a bloody genius. But at the time, I was just spooked. Spooked and a little pissed off. I pulled my feet up onto the rock and started to dry them with my socks, and a little flat cloud went across the sun and turned off the beauty like a switch. 'You look like a drain,' I said to the stream, and it giggled at me smugly. So there's nasty little reeds in it, with like dirty cotton buds in the tops of them. I just noticed them. It took forever to get my socks on, and when I stood up, I couldn't see my way back, only forward to the grey house, and still the wind blowing through the grass like I was locked in a Wyeth landscape. 'Air, air,' said a voice in my ear, and yeah, I got the fear. I split my Converses on that path. I lost my sunnies. I ran for the psycho house, the black door and the great brass knocker coming into focus like a life belt. I battered that door. I hung on to that knocker even when the door opened. And who opened it? Not a corpse, which I was honestly by that time expecting. Not her nightiness either, thank Christ, which had also crossed my mind. More Laura Ashley vintage weirdness, though. What I think about that is, it's a look, but it's actually quite a demanding one. You need a bit of height, shoulders, cheekbones, and definitely the Daily Timotei to carry it off. and the lady in front of me had none of these things. Her head came up, no kidding, to my bra, and her hair was like embalmed into a bun. But at least she smiled at me. Clever grey eyes and a pale little face. She said, "Good day." "I'm looking for Ellis Bell," I said, and she actually clapped. "You're from the agency," she said. "Thank God." So there you are, you see. Next time you get started on the Susanna got off on the wrong foot with Charlotte crap, no you do, I've heard you at it, I'd like you to remember that little scene. Tiny, tough, white little hands, button cuffs, clapping. Charlotte, clapping. And what did I do next? Well, lots, actually. Lots of smiling, lots of chatting. I cope fantastically, I'd say, considering I'd run over a moor and been scared half witless by a lunatic. I was right in there, going, "Gosh, gosh, what a super place. Is that real lime wash? I love the distressed look on the walls. Is it genuine lamp black? How do you do, Anne? No, of course I understand that some people don't talk and prefer to sit by the fire and gibber. Gibbering is my favourite thing too. Look, I sat right down in their lunatic low-carbon co-op kitchen. I said, "Super, a real stove." I did not say, "Oh my God, who poured a pan of grease down your weird little sofa? And what is that heap of dung on a plate?" I sat on the fucker and ate the flaming rock cake. When they pointed at the parlour door and went, "Shh, shh," I shushed, like it was really super normal to be scared stiff of your dad when you're 32. I whispered, "And do you write yourself, Charlotte? Poems? Lovely. And Belgium? What a super theme. Could I have a look? Might I take it back to London with me, Charlotte? Oh, super Charlotte, and I'll definitely hire a flaming horse or pigeon or some other fucker to get back to you. And you know, and let you know what I think of your sweaty recollections of your boarding school teacher." A fine start with Charlotte. Do you take my point? Anyway, what was your start with Charlotte, Giles? I showed you, Professor. You agreed with me. Change the gender, put in a hunky doctor, add like a dead nun, and try for the Twilight Mums market. You didn't say put her on a retainer, because otherwise she'll skip off to Hills Wilton with our sage advice in a pocket, and that book will win the Orange Prize and be on Richard and Judy too, and keep us and one of our better publishers and funds for the next millennium. Or did you? Oh, well, maybe I didn't hear it. The next bit, I admit, I didn't do so well, but I was set up. Picture this, okay? No, feel this. Put yourself in my ripped Converses. Nibble the disgusting rock cakes. You're just about calming down, just about to say to Anne, who's come to sit beside you and is gently and a little spookily fingering your sweatshirt and murmuring about a hard life and something she's been writing, and you're just thinking, wow, do we have an abuse memoir here? When the kitchen door opens and in comes the goblin of the moor. You'd scream, right? Well, I didn't. I just went, "Woo!" Not, "You scared the fuck out of me," or, "Don't you think you should wear underwear with cheesecloth?" Just like, "Woo! Woohoo!" she said, "Woohoo, London!" And she started to dance around the room, like a mime, you know? She picked up this rock cake and made like it was a phone, waving it about. "Reception, reception!" And I'm thinking, I get the feeling that you're Ellis Bell, baby. And I'm losing faith in your oeuvre, big time. Now, that's honest, and I stand by it. You see, when I go looking for writers, I'm looking for the package, not a screwball, you know? I want warm, handsome, presentable, telly-friendly, non-abusive. I want Patrick Gale, every time. Oh, really? Yeah, well, maybe it's a generational thing, Giles. 20 years is a long time in this business, and, like, the internet happened, and all the drunk, pervy guys are dead, and... Yeah, oh yeah, I agree. Okay, let's get anywhere. Let's leave it there. Where was I? Oh, yes. Watching the goblin dancing. Well, Charlotte gets embarrassed, and she says, "Susanna is an agent, Emily, all the way from London." "An agent of the devil," says Emily, still dancing. "A literary agent," hisses Charlotte. "Susanna, this is Ellis Bell." I figured, I said, we actually met. Emily flops into an armchair, stares at me, starts picking at her rock cake. "A literary agent," she says. "And what is the book which sets your heart beating, Susanna? What is the literature that raises your doggish hackles?" And she did a little dog mine. Woof, woof. "Well," I say very politely, "I was awfully interested in Ellis Bell and his poems." Emily waves the cat cake about her head. Do you want to bite them, she says. Do they inflame you? And no kidding, she runs her hand down her nightie in this really inappropriately sexy way. Anne has her head in her little hands. Charlotte, though, is grinning. Now, that is the point I fucked up. I know it. If I'd given a different answer right then, I could have left with the MS of Wuthering in my satchel, I'm sure of it. Because, of course, Emily's interested in money and fame, really. A certain sort of fame. I think we've seen enough since the Booker to confirm that for us. Oh, come on. The whole of the Observer mag? The photo shoot on the moor? The collaboration with Fleming All Saints? Do you really call that art? Okay, you do. Art. Should have mentioned it, shouldn't I? Susanna should have said, yes, the poems inflame my heart with the truth of great art and it makes me sweat and salivate, but as it happens, I didn't. I looked at the sneering goblin. Yeah, she photographs nicely, but have you noticed, always in profile, mouth shut, no teeth, you heard it here first. And I said, no, but I think you have a great font. Ever thought of developing an app? Now, at that point, obviously, things have gone quite wrong for Susanna. And indeed, Charlotte does move off to a different agency where she's developing a way over personal relationship with James at Hills Wilton. And Jane Eyre has been a massive teenage crossover success. And Emily, though, has self-published, which is what's really, really annoyed the agents and all their publishers. But they nevertheless... Susanna is still bringing something to the table, and this is what it is. I'm sounding bitter. Bitter is not good. Bitter is not my theme of the day. I'm here to accentuate the positive. What I need you and the firm to concentrate on now is Anne and the future. Anne, bless her. It's no exaggeration to say I owe her my life. I was already half a mile off the path when she popped up beside me and took my arm. I was just yards from the boggy bit where Edgar the taxi driver drowned. I could have been a Seamus Heaney poem, easy as splish, splash, splosh. As it was, she walked me right out of the pixels, waited till the cab came, and talked me through the whole story. I gave her my iPhone, she gave me Tennant that day. A nice day shopping in any other context. No, come on, Tennant got a major Betty Trask. Its sales are more than adequate, and she's segued into self-help just seamlessly. AA America is really interested in a tour. And it's Anne, let me remind you, who brought us this. The MS I've got on my desk right now. The one I really want some help with, Giles. What? Giles, it's glowing. It's a rags, riches, misery memoir that's going to be huge in the States, plus a parenting how-to book to outsell baby Mozart. How a boy from an incredibly humble background in Ireland escaped poverty, abuse and literacy to rub shoulders with the careless rich and excitingly pervy in Cambridge University. How he won and lost the love of his life. How he settled in the wilds of North Yorkshire and entered into a unique family experiment. How he raised not one, not two, not three, but four authentic geniuses. Yes, we are counting Bramwell. Tattoos were only ever a sideline. He's really in demand in thrash metal CD covers now, and he's cleaned up. Might even go to with Anne on the tour. Anyway, just picture it. This is what we're all going to be reading this Christmas. I'm seeing monochrome cover, red indent lettering, Patrick Brunty, My Story, and a subtitle, Genius, How You Can Raise One Too. Because in the end, Giles, isn't that what we all want to know? Not the highfalutin stuff, the Emily romance, the Charlotte art. No, the real stuff, the stuff we can apply to our actual lives. That's what Anne's got, and Patrick too, once you get past his super scary 9-foot-tall mad Irish persona. He's the centre of the action, remember, up in that house. His was the door that was closed, and now Burns Pope Wild can open it. I'm seeing serial here, Giles. I'm seeing spin-offs. I'm seeing chat show. I'm seeing opera. Trust me, Giles, it may have taken a few years to get here, but this is the real story.
Yes. Did you want some slides? Yeah. I'm going to stay here, actually, because I don't like lecterns. So can you all hear me okay with just this mic? Excellent. So I was asked... I don't write short stories myself. I did write lots of ghost stories as a child. Sadly, they've all been lost. But I was asked to read a ghost story that I liked. which was a very nice thing to be invited to do, because I looked at lots of my favourite stories, like The Monkey's Paw, for example. It's not exactly a ghost story, but it's a fabulous story by W.W. Jacobs. And Elizabeth Bowen's The Demon Lover, if you know that, is another great one. But they were all a bit long, and I really, because it's a short story festival, I wanted to read a complete story. So then I thought of a story by Graham Greene, who isn't a writer we normally associate with ghost stories. And I think sometimes writers who only ever produce one or two ghost stories in their career can sometimes do some very interesting things. And this is a story he wrote in 1939 called A Little Place Off the Edgware Road. And it's very far removed from the traditional British ghost story, which often has a rather genteel sort of setting. It's very gritty and urban, grubby, and it's full of Graham Greene-type Catholic torture, I suppose, Catholic self-torture. So I'm going to read this, and I hope it's a very odd story. I don't know, it's not strictly speaking a ghost story, or is it? I don't know, but there's definitely something very strange and supernatural going on. Okay, it's about 10 minutes long. Right, A Little Place Off the Edgware Road. Craven came up past the Achilles statue in the thin summer rain. It was only just after lighting up time, but already the cars were lined up all the way to the Marble Arch, and the sharp, acquisitive faces peered out ready for a good time with anything possible which came along. Craven went bitterly by with the collar of his Macintosh tight around his throat. It was one of his bad days. All the way up the park he was reminded of passion, but you needed money for love. All that a poor man could get was lust. Love needed a good suit, a car, a flat somewhere, or a good hotel. It needed to be wrapped in cellophane. He was aware all the time of the stringy tie beneath his Macintosh and the frayed sleeves. He carried his body about with him like something he hated. There were moments of happiness in the British Museum reading room, but the body called him back. He bore as his only sentiment the memory of ugly deeds committed on park chairs. People talked as if the body died too soon. That wasn't the trouble to Craven at all. The body kept alive, and through the glittering tinselly rain, on his way to a rostrum, he passed a little man in a black suit carrying a banner, "The body shall rise again." He remembered a dream from which three times he'd woken, trembling. He'd been alone in the huge, dark, cavernous burying ground of all the world. Every grave was connected to another under the ground. The globe was honeycombed for the sake of the dead, and on each occasion of dreaming, he'd discovered anew the horrifying fact that the body doesn't decay. There are no worms and dissolution. Under the ground, the world was littered with masses of dead flesh, ready to rise again with their warts and boils and eruptions. He had lain in bed and remembered, as tidings of great joy, that the body, after all, was corrupt. He came up into the Edgware Road walking fast. The guardsmen were out in couples, great languid, elongated beasts, the bodies like worms in their tight trousers. He hated them, and hated his hatred because he knew what it was, envy. He was aware that every one of them had a better body than himself. Indigestion creased his stomach. He felt sure that his breath was foul, but who could he ask? Sometimes he secretly touched himself here and there with scent. It was one of his ugliest secrets. Why should he be asked to believe in the resurrection of this body he wanted to forget? Sometimes he prayed at night that his body, at any rate, should never rise again. He knew all the side streets around the Edgware Road only too well. When a mood was on, he simply walked until he tired, squinting at his own image in the windows of Salmon and Gluckstein and the ABCs. So he noticed at once the posters outside the disused theatre in Culpar Road. They were not unusual, for sometimes Barclays Bank Dramatic Society would hire the place for an evening, or an obscure film would be trade shown there. The theatre had been built in 1920 by an optimist who thought that the cheapness of the site would more than counterbalance its disadvantage of lying a mile outside the conventional theatre zone. But no play had ever succeeded, and it was soon left to gather rat holes and spider webs. The covering of the seats was never renewed, and all that ever happened to the place was the temporary false life of an amateur play or a trade show. Craven stopped and read. There were still optimists, it appeared, even in 1939, for nobody but the blindest optimist could hope to make money out of the place as the home of the silent film. The first season of Primitives was announced. There would never be a second. Well, the seats were cheap, and it was perhaps worth a shilling to him now that he was tired to get in somewhere out of the rain. Craven bought a ticket and went into the darkness of the stalls. In the dead darkness, a piano tinkled something monotonous, recalling Mendelssohn. He sat down in a gangway seat and could immediately feel the emptiness all round him. No, there would never be another season. On the screen, a large woman in a kind of toga wrung her hands, then wobbled with curious jerky movements towards a couch. There she sat and stared out like a sheepdog distractedly through her loose and black and stringy hair. Sometimes she seemed to dissolve altogether into dots and flashes and wiggly lines. A subtitle said, Pompilia, betrayed by her beloved Augustus, seeks an end to her troubles. Craven began at last to see a dim waste of stalls. There were not 20 people in the place, a few couples whispering with their heads touching, and a number of lonely men like himself wearing the same uniform of the cheap Macintosh. They lay about at intervals like corpses, and again Craven's obsession returned, the toothache of horror. He thought miserably, I'm going mad, other people don't feel like this. Even a disused theatre reminded him of those interminable caverns where the bodies were waiting for resurrection. A slave to his passion, Augustus calls for yet more wine. A gross middle-aged Teutonic actor lay on an elbow with his arm round a large woman in a shift. The spring song tinkled ineptly on, and the screen flickered like indigestion. Somebody felt his way through the darkness, scrabbling past Craven's knees. A small man, Craven experienced the unpleasant feeling of a large beard brushing his mouth. Then there was a long sigh as the newcomer found the next chair, and on the screen events had moved on with such rapidity that Pompilia had already stabbed herself, or so Craven supposed, and lay still and buxom among her weeping slaves. A low, breathless voice sighed out close to Craven's ear. What's happened? Is she asleep? No, said Craven. Dead. Murdered? The voice asked with keen interest. I don't think so. Stabbed herself. Nobody said hush. Nobody was enough interested to object to a voice. They drooped among the empty chairs in attitudes of weary inattention. The film wasn't nearly over yet. There were children somehow to be considered. Was it all going on to a second generation? But the small bearded man in the next seat seemed to be interested only in Pompilia's death. The fact that he'd come in at that moment apparently fascinated him. Craven heard the word coincidence twice, and he went on talking to himself about it in low, out-of-breath tones, absurd when you come to think of it, and then no blood at all. Craven didn't listen. He sat with his hands clasped between his knees, facing the fact, as he had faced it so often before, that he was in danger of going mad. He had to pull himself up, take a holiday, see a doctor. God knew what infection moved in his veins. He became aware that his bearded neighbour had addressed him directly. What? He asked impatiently. What did you say? There would be more blood than you can imagine. What are you talking about? When the man spoke to him, he sprayed him with damp breath. There was a little bubble in his speech like an impediment. He said, when you murder a man... This was a woman, Craven said impatiently. That wouldn't make any difference. And it's got nothing to do with murder anyway. That doesn't signify. They seem to have got into an absurd and meaningless wrangle in the dark. I know, you see, the little bearded man said in a tone of enormous conceit. Know what? About such things, he said, with guarded ambiguity. Craven turned and tried to see him clearly. Was he mad? Was this a warning of what he himself might become, babbling incomprehensibly to strangers in cinemas? He thought, by God, no, trying to see. I'll be sane yet, I will be sane. He could make out nothing but a small black hump of body. The man was talking to himself again. He said, talk, such talk. They'll say it was all for £50, but that's a lie. Reasons and reasons. They always take the first reason, never look behind. 30 years of reasons. Such simpletons, he added again in that tone of breathlessness and unbounded conceit. So this was madness. So long as he could realise that, Craven must be sane himself, relatively speaking. Not so sane, perhaps, as the seekers in the park or the guardsmen in the Edgware Road, but saner than this. It was like a message of encouragement as the piano tinkled on. Then again, the little man turned and sprayed him. Killed herself, you say, but who's to know that? It's not a mere question of what hand holds the knife. He laid a hand suddenly and confidingly on Craven's. It was damp and sticky. Craven said with horror, as a possible meaning came to him, what are you talking about? I know, the little man said. A man in my position gets to know almost everything. What is your position? Craven asked, feeling the sticky hand on his, trying to make up his mind whether he was being hysterical or not. After all, there were a dozen explanations. It might be treacle. A pretty desperate one, you'd say, said the man. Sometimes the voice almost died in the throat altogether. Something incomprehensible had happened on the screen. Take your eyes from these early pictures for a moment, and the plot had proceeded on at such a pace. Only the actors moved slowly and jerkily. A young woman in a nightdress seemed to be weeping in the arms of a Roman centurion. Craven hadn't seen either of them before. "I'm not afraid of death, Lucius, in your arms." The little man began to titter knowingly. He was talking to himself again. It would have been easy to ignore him altogether if it hadn't been for those sticky hands, which he now removed. He seemed to be fumbling at the seat in front of him. His head had a habit of lolling sideways, like an idiot child's. He said distinctly and irrelevantly, "Bayswater tragedy." "What was that?" Craven said. He'd seen those words on a poster before he entered the park. "What?" asked the man. "About the tragedy." "To think they call Cullen Mews Bayswater." Suddenly the little man began to cough, turning his face towards Craven and coughing right at him. It was like vindictiveness. The voice said, "Let me see, my umbrella." He was getting up. "You didn't have an umbrella," said Craven. "My umbrella," he repeated, "my..." and seemed to lose the word altogether. He went scrabbling out past Craven's knees. Craven let him go, but before he'd reached the billowy, dusty curtains of the exit, the screen went blank and bright. The film had broken, and somebody immediately turned up one dirt-choked chandelier above the circle. It shone down just enough for Craven to see the smear on his hands. This wasn't hysteria. This was a fact. He wasn't mad. He had sat next to a madman who, in some muse, what was the name? Colon? Colin? Craven jumped up and made his own way out. The black curtain flapped in his mouth. But he was too late. The man had gone, and there were three turnings to choose from. He chose instead a telephone box and dialed, with a sense odd for him of sanity and decision, 999. It didn't take 2 minutes to get the right department. They were interested and very kind. Yes, there had been a murder in a mews, Cullen Mews. A man's neck had been cut from ear to ear with a bread knife, a horrid crime. He began to tell them how he'd sat next to the murderer in a cinema. It couldn't be anyone else. There was blood on his hands, and he remembered with repulsion as he spoke the damp beard. There must have been a terrible lot of blood. But the voice from the yard interrupted him. "Oh, no," it was saying, "we have the murderer. No doubt of it at all. It's the body that's disappeared." Craven put down the receiver. He said to himself aloud, "Why should this happen to me? Why to me?" He was back in the horror of his dream. The squalid, darkening street outside was only one of the innumerable tunnels connecting grave to grave where the imperishable bodies lay. He said it was a dream. And leaning forward, he saw in the mirror above the telephone his own face sprinkled by tiny drops of blood like dew from a scent spray. He began to scream, "I won't go mad, I won't go mad, I'm sane, I won't go mad." Presently, a little crowd began to collect, and soon a policeman came.
Yes, I didn't realise when we agreed to this order, I didn't quite think I would be going after Graham Greene. So you'll have to forgive me. This is a story called Car. It is about a car. Maybe that is all I will say. It's 2:30 a.m. when you leave the party. You wouldn't usually have stayed so late, but the company was excellent, the food enticing, the wine superb. You're not drunk. You're careful about such things, especially when driving. You had one small glass early on, and despite the alluring tinkle of crystal and booming pop of corks, you left it at that. But for some reason, you can't find your car. You had to park on a side road, and you're not familiar with this part of town. It's made up of narrow, winding streets, lined with parked cars and tiny, picturesque cottages. They're probably astonishingly expensive, you think, as you turn another corner, where you're sure this time, totally sure, you must have parked. Your car's not there. You keep walking, looping back towards where you started. If you really can't find it, you'll have to beg your friends to let you stay the night, look again in the morning, or report it stolen. Then a thought occurs. You pull out your keys and press the fob. Sure enough, from just around the corner, you hear the reassuring double blip of your car unlocking. You do it again, walking faster, then once more, then again, turning the corner. But it's not your car. You press the fob again. The car in front of you unlocks. It's a long, sleek, black vehicle, German-looking, although you don't recognise the make. The windows are dark. It's low slung to the ground. Its wheel rims are black. The street lights barely seem to illuminate it at all. Mounted at the front of the bonnet is a small silver figure of a leaping wolf. You press the fob again. It locks. You glide your fingers along the black trim at the edge of the roof. You think it through logically. You've read somewhere that the chances of the same infrared key unlocking two different cars is about 30 million to one. Nonetheless, it must happen sometimes. Perhaps, earlier in the evening, the owner of this beautiful, sleek black car found that their key unlocked yours too. Perhaps they stood there, amused, staring at the empty crisp packet in the driver's side pocket and the dirty carpet, and decided to slum it for an evening. Perhaps they were tired, suddenly, of their wealth and success, wanted to remember what it had been like when they were young and their mother drove them to school in a car like yours. You could go back to your friends, file a report on your missing car, stay up until probably 4 or 5 in the morning trying to sort everything out. Or you could drive home now, in this fluid-lined beast, get a good night's sleep, and deal with it fresh in the morning. You stand on the street for a few moments thinking, and then you unlock the car, open the door, and get in. You turn on the engine. Is it a little improbable that your key would turn it on as well as opening it? Possibly. But you do not think about this until a great deal later. You're grateful to be able to get home easily. You're not drunk, but you are tired. You should remember that. The car roars into life, settling down to a thrumming purr. The crisply designed display glows warm orange behind the polished to invisibility glass. The seats are soft black leather. The car smells new. There are less than 1,000 miles on the clock. You let out a little sigh of pleasure. You find that the controls are all where you expect them to be. You're glad to see this car has a built-in sat-nav. You had a lot of trouble finding your friend's house in the first place. The one-way system seemed to lead constantly away from it. You'd been a bit worried about how you'd get back. You turn on the device and program in your address. It predicts that the journey will take 35 minutes. You're relieved. It took you almost an hour to get here. You flick the indicator down. The thick, snapping sound it makes is delicious. And pull away. For a while, it's all you can do not to keep admiring the car's features as you drive. You wish it were daytime so you could appreciate the styling properly. The steering wheel under your hands is both soft and firm, like the welcoming handshake of a new and lucrative business partner. The sat-nav, too, is mellifluous, its inky velvet voice instructing you to turn left, bear right. In 300 metres, take the motorway. You're not familiar with the route it's taking you, but it's going to be quicker, that's all to the good. You take your eyes off the empty road momentarily to turn on the radio. A voice speaking in a language unfamiliar to you fills the car. The sound system so perfectly attuned that it sounds as if she's sitting right behind you, and you almost look back in surprise. You flick through the presets. All different languages, none that you speak fluently. Although you linger for a moment over one of the more familiar tongues, hoping to pick up a word or two. At last, after another couple of turns directed by the sat-nav, you manually tune the radio to your favourite station and relax. You've been driving for about 15 minutes now, but you don't recognise anything around you. The sat-nav is probably taking you a route perfectly calibrated to minimise your journey time, avoiding traffic, roadworks, maybe even stoplights. You haven't hit a red since you started driving, you recall. Astonishing what they can do nowadays. You reflect, amusing yourself, that a car like this might even have special roads which normal people like you don't get to use. You drive on. The lights of the town are to your right, but they seem further away than you'd have expected. You're on an empty road stretching out across open country. It's lined with elm trees, each with that distinctive leaf-shaped silhouette rustling in the breeze. You glance at the few scattered buildings by the side of the road as you pass, trying to work out where you are. There's a children's playground, empty, of course. There's a house with dark windows. As you drive past, you think you see a face observing you from an upstairs floor, but you are probably mistaken. Only 10 minutes to go until you get there, says the sat-nav. But you really don't recognise anything. This can't be right. Perhaps there are two roads with the same name, and it's taking you to the wrong one. You drive on, following the instructions almost mechanically. You'll see where it's taking you, but stop at a petrol station and ask where you are. Buy an A to Z, get home. How irritating. But there's no petrol station. You drive on and on, along what looked like main roads, but there are no shops along them, no lighted windows even. Only the occasional dark house. At least the tank is full of petrol, you notice, unable to help admiring the curved dial of the petrol indicator. If necessary, you'll drive on. You'll eventually find something open or some signs. Thinking about it, it's been a long time since you last saw a sign. Probably not since you were quite near your friend's house. It occurs to you that since you put in an address, a street, and house number, there must be houses wherever you're going. It's probably a good idea to carry on. The sat-nav instructs you to turn off from the main road, down a single-lane track. The road is well maintained, but with the trees bowed over it and no houses on either side, it doesn't look like you'll find a petrol station up there. You pause on the main road, your indicator flashing. No other vehicle around to be irritated by your vacillation. What to do? You try to reprogram the sat-nav, pressing its glossy screen with your fingers, but it doesn't seem to be responding. Every time you press, it just says, "In 500 metres, you have reached your destination." Fine. If you have to drive down there to get it to cancel this journey and start again, so be it. You turn the steering wheel and proceed down the track. You notice, as you pass, that the road has no name sign, and feel, frankly, irritated. The road is narrow and the car is wide. As you drive, long fingers of tree branches seem to reach out and fumble at the doors. For no clear reason, without thinking about it too hard, wondering at the same time why you didn't do so earlier, you lock the car doors from the inside. You drive slowly with the headlights on full beam. You think you catch sight of a loping animal crossing the road ahead of you, like a fox but lower to the ground, more like a badger but much bigger. But it's gone in an instant. You wish it were light. It won't be light for hours. You want to turn on the car's internal lights but think to yourself, no, then they'll be able to see inside. After a moment, you realise there's no one else around. Who would see inside? You take a few deep breaths. You're very tired, after all. You have reached your destination, the velvety dark voice says at last. You look around. You really have reached some kind of destination. The road only runs on for another few hundred metres before coming to an end, a line of trees beginning a dense forest. On your right, the road is lined by forest, but on the left there's a break in the trees. A path runs slightly downhill, through an open gate and across a lawn to a large house set back from the road. The house has 6 windows on each floor, and 2 floors. In one of the upstairs windows, a light is burning. It is the first certain sign you've seen of anyone else who's still awake since you got into the car. You think about climbing out, walking across the dark lawn and ringing the bell of the old house. That might be sensible. Ask directions, find out where you are, where the sat-nav has led you wrongly. But as you reach for the door, something in you recoils. It's the thought of the long, dark walk across the lawn, with the trees whispering in the wind, bending over to get closer to you. And when you reach the house and ring the bell, what will happen? Someone will answer, you tell yourself, someone perfectly normal. Your hand moves towards the door handle, but stops short, comes back to your lap. This is ridiculous. You're in a car. The petrol tank is full. The car is obviously well maintained. There's no reason to stay here in this wooded cul-de-sac when you could go back to the motorway and drive on. You could drive till dawn if necessary. That can only be another couple of hours from now. The road is narrow, but you're a skilled driver. You'll be able to turn the car around. Quickly, almost tipping over into panic, but not quite, you find reverse gear and start to back round, turning the wheel clockwise, so the boot of your car almost touches the trees behind. You find yourself thinking, don't touch the trees, but you don't know why. You've made a quarter turn. You turn the wheel anti-clockwise and start to move forward a little, so that the car is facing the old house with its single lit upstairs window. You straighten up. The car is at right angles to the little road, its back next to the trees, its front facing the house. You prepare to start backing round. That is when the engine cuts out. The radio is still working. Your favourite station is still burbling on quite happily. The car's lights are still on, illuminating the stone steps down the embankment to the path across the lawn, but the low, throaty rumble of the engine has ceased. Instinctively, you turn the key, turning everything off, planning to restart the engine. You hadn't thought that when you turned the key, you'd be plunged into darkness. For that moment, the only light you can see is the light in the upper window of the house. You think you see other things too. It seems in that moment that there is something on the lawn, something creeping slowly across it, illuminated only by the light from the window. You think you hear something moving in the woods behind you. You scrabble for the key, pumping the accelerator to bring the engine back to life. The lights turn back on, the radio comes back on, but the engine is dead. You don't want to try turning it off again. You try to think rationally. You can't stay here all night. The car's battery will run down, and then you'll be left in the dark. You reach for your mobile phone, but there's no signal, no matter how many different directions you turn it in. But the comforting tiny light of the screen makes you think, that's all you need, more light. Maybe there's a torch in this car, a floodlight even. A car like this, the owner would surely be prepared for all emergencies. Using the faint beam of your mobile phone's light, you sweep across the back seat. There's nothing there. You look in the footwell, as far as you can without getting out of the car. There's a noise from the wood, a low hiss. You crane round, trying to see what's there. You can't see anything unusual. The trees are bending in the wind, reaching towards the car. You open the glove compartment. Your heart rejoices. There's a torch. You turn it on. Good. It's heavy duty, with a powerful beam. You heft the thing in your hand. It makes you feel better. You shine the torch into the glove compartment. Is there anything else there? Yes. There's something at the back, wrapped tightly in a piece of soft black fabric. You put your hand into the glove compartment and pull the thing out. You unwrap it. Your heart is beating so loudly in your throat that you can scarcely bear it. The thing is a hammer, with a flat head and a claw head. You shine the torch on the flat head. There are red splashes, with some hairs stuck to dull metal. As if your head were being pulled on a string, you turn around to stare at the dark back seat. You swing your torch in wide, terrified circles, poking into the corners behind you, then suddenly back to the passenger seat, then back to the seats behind. You cannot make enough light to keep everywhere in view at once. Outside, the wind stirs up the trees and they rustle as if whispering to one another. The back seat is empty, but you cannot stop staring back. Behind the back seat, right behind it, is the only place you haven't looked in this car. The boot. Right there. You do not want to open the boot. You do not want to get out of the car. You turn back to look at the house. The light on the upper floor is moving. You watch it waver in the upstairs room, moving from side to side and then past to the next room, then to the middle windows where the staircase must be. It is coming downstairs. There is a soft click from behind you. The boot has swung open. There is a sound of movement. You can see something moving. You say to yourself, it must be the trees, but you know what it is. You have known for a while now. You know what you did. Something is moving. It has the jerky precision of a marionette. It is climbing out of the boot. You thought no one had ever known the truth. It has been 20 years, and you thought you were free. The radio softly fades away. The headlights of the car begin to die. You are holding the torch in your hand, and you could turn it towards the back of the car to see what's coming, but you cannot. You turn back, forcing yourself to stare at the old stone mansion. In the house, the light has reached the ground floor. There is a tap, tap, tap at the window of the car. You do not turn your head. You sit staring forward as the headlights of the car finally fade away. It is dark, and in the darkness, things are creeping slowly across the lawn. They are coming for you. The sat-nav begins to speak. Be sure, it says in its smooth, dark voice. Be sure your sins will find you out. The tapping at the window begins again. You wait. It will not be long.
My thanks to Naomi, to Kate, and to Sarah for those stories. Somebody said before we came into the barn that perhaps we should be having this kind of event in the evening when it's dark outside. I'm really glad we're not. That was definitely spooky enough, thank you. I have to use that phrase, her nightiness. That's such a good phrase. I was thinking, Sarah, with Graham Greene, it's just a delight to hear a story that you've not heard before. You know, I'm a bit of a Graham Greene fan, and then to hear one that it's just lovely, absolute treat. So thank you. Thank you to all of you. We haven't got a huge amount of time, Diana, what would you like us to do? We want to keep some time for questions for you to ask the panel. Think we should go straight to questions? Okay. I mean, no doubt some of the things we were going to talk about will come up anyway. So, right, I actually can't see terribly well, but could I invite questions, please, for the panel on our theme?
If you want to ask a question, could you raise your hand and there's a roving mic coming to you?
There's somebody over there by the wall with a sort of reddish... Yeah, that's it. Just about see.
Or just shout.
That's it.
I just wanted to ask mainly Naomi. I'm not sure myself about using the second person as well as the present tense. I like the present tense. I'm not sure about the second person, and I'm wondering, and I gather that's quite fashionable, and I wondered where it's come from and what its advantages are, and the rest of the panel might have a view.
It's interesting, isn't it? I've become quite taken with it in recent years, I think. Partly I'm interested in, as you said, I do indeed write computer games, and a lot of modern technology addresses you in the second person. There's a lot of being told what you're doing and being told what you ought to do. And certainly a sat-nav will tell you in the second person, will go, you have reached your destination. So for this sort of story, I felt there is something about technology that kind of... It's sort of horrifying that it will tell you what you should do, what you are doing, who you are, you know, all of that sort of Facebook, you're friends with so-and-so, you've just done this. And so I'm quite interested in seeing how you can bring that sense of both presence and sort of sometimes horrifying complicity. I mean, there's the great novel Complicity by Ian Banks, which is also in the second person, where you have to start off with making the reader do things. There's something accusatory about it, as if you're saying to the reader, you're doing this, you're doing that. So you have to start off somewhere where the reader goes, oh yeah, that is probably the kind of thing maybe I would do. And then by the end, you take them somewhere else.
Well, I thought it worked absolutely brilliantly, and I think it's especially good for a spooky story because it takes away one extra layer between the reader and the action. Because often we read spooky stories because they're like ghost trains. They're spooky for a while, and then there's this kind of safe. We come out of the ghost train, and it's sort of back to normal, and it's sort of slightly cathartic, I suppose. But there's you know, this removes that little bit of distance. It makes it really immediate. Hey. A bit dreamlike. I like that about it as well.
It's got the quality of a puzzle, hasn't it? Mm. So if you do this and then you do this, then what's the answer? And most of the time I'm saying, yes, I probably would take that solution. And then right at the end you go, oh, no, maybe. But here's a problem with no answer, except the unacceptable one. So, yeah, that's what it's for, isn't it?
I do think if it's trendy, I think it's trendy because games and technology use it a lot. And I think probably people who are using it now are trying to tackle those areas where you go, okay, what do these bits, what does this iPhone mean for me? But yes, I love it anyway.
Modern technology is very scary. I think that came out of business schools.
Yes, that's right.
The pixels is a very ghostly region.
Yes.
Yes, I have to say you did succeed in putting me off sat there.
And actually, can I just pick up? There's a story in the anthology called Ibea Blue by Jacqueline Brooks, I think. I don't know if she's here, but that's a wonderful example of exploring the ghostly potential of the internet. You know, which is always sending us voices, disembodied voices, and disembodied messages. It has a wonderful supernatural feel to it.
And where people can live forever live way beyond.
Yes. Mm. And where emails can be sent after somebody's death if they've been programmed to, as happens in the story, perhaps. Mm.
And aren't ghost stories somehow often the best ones about something, some anxiety of the age? So, I mean, M.R. James, who is a genius, it's a lot about sex, actually. It's a lot about women and that fantastic story, I Whistle and I'll Come to You, My Lad, where the final apparition is a ghostly white figure made of linen arising from the empty bed next to him. You're like, that is a woman there, M.R. James, who lived, you know, by himself as a Cambridge don. There's something about that. So I think it's probably really interesting that things are moving on to talk about that.
Or it might be a man. I mean, let's not exclude that possibility. His stories are very sort of homosocial. You know, they're often almost exclusively peopled by male characters. So I think you're right that there is a lot of desire there, sort of just under the surface.
I like that interpretation.
Okay, I can see someone back there on that side towards the wall again.
Is it on?
Yeah.
Okay. I was just really curious about the different language that was being used. In terms of Kate, the sort of wonderful language of the wind, I think it was the wind burped, that I certainly wrote down, and her nightiness. And I felt that Naomi, that was really more to do with the sort of the plot, and actually was using what I would say is kind of quite simple language. And so my question is really, are you deliberately patterning and choosing language to have an impact at certain points, or are you deliberately choosing not to do that?
Well, it's the voice of the story. So, you know, one of the great things about being able to do prose now, or why I want to do prose, is that I can do people's voices. And I think Susanna is that voice. The sort of witty, sharp, deliberately urban voice. She swears a lot. I was reading. She's very blue-mouthed, is Susanna. So I was more thinking about her, and it is a very... She's got a deliberately anti-romantic voice, and she is, you know, she describes the stream exactly as Emily Bronte would not have done, I suppose. But I enjoyed inhabiting that. I thought she was quite funny.
She's funny.
Yes.
And you're absolutely right, aren't you, that there is a voice for every story, and each one demands something a bit different. And it's particularly fun writing short stories several in a row, because you just get to do such range. And certainly for that, I felt that... I based it all on how a sat nav talks, so it's all very simple and logical and precise, and do this and then you do that and then you do that until something terrible happens.
You've got a great sat nav voice. I wanted to compliment you on that. You ever wanted a sideline, you know.
I think there's a John Cleese sat nav you can get.
I think it's lovely as well to sort of hear there's a sort of wide interpretation in all three stories of gothic, ghostly, and I don't know, just sort of as a quick point to the panel, whether you felt in your writing of the stories, but also in the reading of the entrance, whether there was a very wide interpretation. Sarah Bowes.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the pleasures of judging the competition, really, you know, was seeing how a story could remain a ghost story, remain a gothic story. Lots of them were actually technically ghost stories, but you know, all of them were gothic. They could remain very much within the tradition and yet push it in all sorts of new directions, push it and test it and add new things to it or bring it up to date with new technology. And yet still, as I say, remain faithful and be mindful of the tradition and have fun with it. You know, I really admired that. Mm-hmm.
Incidentally, if people like M.R. James, I think the house in that story is the house in the Mezzotint. And if you haven't read the Mezzotint, go and read it.
Okay, I think we've got time for one, maybe two more questions. Anyone from the audience like to ask either anything about what the stories that the writers read, or indeed about the theme, gothic, ooh, ghostly, right in the centre, towards the centre aisle, halfway up.
It's sort of tying together the two that we've had already. Talking about, I suppose, narrative viewpoint, we've had a really interesting one, Kate, yours, where it was almost like a monologue, I thought, and Naomi's your second point of view. And I was thinking, Sarah, of The Little Stranger, where you've got the first-person narrative, but seeing sections of the story that he perhaps wasn't present for, but he's still telling us about, and this slight sense of the unreliability of his story. And also in terms of challenging the ghost story and sort of creating new forms, I just wondered if in discovering these new points of view, if that, how that has affected the development of the ghost story.
Right, I'd like to have a go at that one.
The ghost story, in the ghost story, you always have to believe in the uncanny. You've got to believe in the existence of the ghost about 3/4 of the way through, and that usually involves, to some extent, trusting the narrator. So you have to have a narrator who doesn't believe in ghosts, like Craven. You know, he has to assert that he's not mad for us to have the believability of the thing. So I guess Susanna is a kind of very anti-romantic, very dry, and we believe that she would not believe in ghosts, and therefore, you know. And that's the trick that Little Stranger pulls, which is that we have to believe in that doctor. We have to believe in him not believing until almost all the way through.
Yes. I mean, I was very, very mindful of writers like M.R. James, who often do have these bachelor narrators, these scholarly bachelor narrators. And the awful stuff doesn't tend to happen to them. It tends to happen to a friend of theirs or somebody they run into in a hotel by the sea or a golf club or something like that. And so they're seeing the tail end, or they're seeing something dreadful from the obliquely. And I really liked that idea that my narrator started off like one of those men, you know, sort of witnessing these terrible events that he couldn't make sense of. But then actually I became, as you sort of suggested, more interested in him being a bit unreliable as well, and possibly having some sort of a role, perhaps agency in what was going on. So, it was a great...
he did it.
It was a great book to write technically in terms of viewpoint. Mm.
There is something really interesting about viewpoint in ghost stories, because you can't tell the reader too much. I mean, I don't know what you think, but to me, once you really describe the ghost and you really have seen it in all its different ways and you've seen it more, it's nothing. It's not scary at all. It's scary when you allow that gap there. So really hard to do that as a third person. I mean, Graham Greene's a blooming genius, isn't he? But even as a third person, it can be a bit too on the nose. You can find out a bit too much, and that works so beautifully, because you just, you know, it's that the few lines right at the end, you just go, this is not what I thought at all. I think something about that, even however close you are to the person who's seen the ghost, you can't be too near to it. It has to be just a suggestion.
I think we probably need to stop there and hand back to Diana.
I'd like to thank Kate, Sarah, and Naomi for absolutely spine-chilling readings. The ghosts are descending now, obviously. Obviously, to recommend the hot off the press, just launched today, Asham Anthology, published by Virago, they'll be signing at the bookstall as soon as we've finished. We've also got copies of their own books there, as well as the anthology. So go and have a look at them at the bookstall. Just one thing I did want to say, that the competition winners, the Ashram competition winners, their stories in the anthology, many of which have been referred to, are absolutely superb as well. And just to mention that coincidentally, the winner of the Ashram Award, the winning story in this anthology, also won the Small Wonder Slam last night. So we feel, you know, doubly excited by that. Pardon? A bright future ahead. And just very quickly to say about the rest of the events this afternoon, I'm sure you know, as I mentioned, Polly Sampson, one of the judges and commissioned writers, will be reading from her collection later on. And then we're going to be having a discussion about Daphne du Maurier's short stories, and one of her short stories appears in this anthology. So if you haven't already thought about coming to that event, I guess a lot of you are, but do go and check the tickets at the box office. And just to mention, tomorrow, Sunday, it's going to be another lovely day. We've got some amazing writers, Rachel Cuss, Janice Galloway. We've also got a debut short story writer who's suddenly become extremely successful, who wasn't eligible to enter the Ashram competition due to his gender. Tom Rachman at 6 o'clock tomorrow evening. And his debut collection of short stories has just been optioned by Brad Pitt. So if you want to find out how to be optioned by Brad Pitt, as well as appear in the Ashram anthology, come along at 6 o'clock tomorrow evening. He's appearing with Annalena McAfee, who is the editor of the Guardian Review. And she's written a work of fiction about two female journalists, one loosely based on the idealistic war veteran Martha Gellhorn, and the other one a contemporary celebrity journalist. So you can imagine the scope for fun and clashes there. And our final event revolves around As It Ought to and Isn't Night, The Arabian Nights, the quintessential collection of short stories 1,000 years old. Anyone interested in short stories must be interested in The Arabian Nights. Because we had a group booking for those events, and in fact the group booking has now shifted to another two events, and we want to end with a bang. Anyone who would like to buy a ticket for Tom Rachman and Annalena McAfee's event at 6 o'clock tomorrow night can also have a ticket for our final event. So that's just a suggestion. Now my last suggestion is we thank the readers. We give a special thank to Stephanie, who stepped into the breach of Lenny Goodings, who's the publisher of Virago, who I know would have loved to be here today. Once we've done that, would you remain seated while I take the speakers to the bookstall, where you can come and bring up a national anthology, one of their books, carrying on a conversation. But first, can we thank them?